Good morning and welcome to the Monday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day. You're not a nice person when it's hot outside, by Amanda McMillan for RealSimple.com. The next time a friend calls you and asks for a favor, how willing you are to lend a hand may have a lot to do with one unexpected factor, the heat. According to a new study in the European Journal of Social Psychology, uncomfortably hot environments make people less likely to help others in need. Past research has demonstrated, and you may certainly agree, that a really hot day can induce feelings of grumpiness and even hostility toward everyone around you. But this is the first study to show a link between ambient temperature and pro-social behaviors, which are essentially those selfless deeds that benefit other people, organizations, or society as a whole, but not explicitly ourselves. To study this connection, researchers from Lehigh University and Northwestern University performed three experiments. In the first, they found that retail store employees were 50% less likely to engage in pro-social behaviors, like volunteering to help customers, listening actively, and making suggestions when they were working in an uncomfortably hot store compared to normal conditions. In the second experiment, even just thinking about hot temperatures was enough to influence helping behaviors. Half of the participants taking a paid online survey were asked to recall situations in which they were uncomfortably hot, and then all of the participants were asked to take another survey for no additional compensation. Only 34% of the people who imagined feeling hot were willing to complete the free survey versus 76% of a control group. Finally, the researchers asked college students seated in either a 69-degree room or an 80-degree room to fill out a survey that would benefit a local nonprofit organization. Only 64% of the students in the hot room agreed to answer at least one question, compared to 95% in the cool room. And those in the hot room who did participate answered only about one-sixth of the questions those in the cool room did. The researchers were able to show that hot and muggy environments increased fatigue and reduced positive mood, which directly led to less helping behavior. Understanding this connection may help people better anticipate and possibly prevent these types of harmful or undesirable behaviors, they say. Even though one cannot control or change the weather itself, it is feasible to control one's ambient environment, they wrote in their paper. Lead author Luba Belkin, associate professor of management at Lehigh University, says the study can offer important advice to workplace supervisors and group leaders. If managers would like to encourage pro-social behavior in their organizations under adverse environment, they should try to minimize job-related stress and create comfortable environments for employees, she says. Expressing empathy and trying to think about situations from their employees' point of view may also help, she says. This article originally appeared on RealSimple.com. Rapper Finesse Two Times arrested on charges unrelated to shooting at his Little Rock concert, by Andrew DeMillo and Taffy Mercaziotti for the Associated Press. Little Rock, Arkansas. A rapper whose concert in Little Rock was the site of a shooting that left 28 people injured was arrested early Sunday on unrelated assault charges while outside an Alabama club where he was performing just 24 hours later, authorities said. Ricky Hampton, 25, of Memphis, Tennessee, also known as Finesse Two Times, was arrested on outstanding charges of aggravated assault with a gun out of Forest City in eastern Arkansas, the U.S. Marshals Service said. Little Rock police said on Twitter that no arrests have been made in the shooting at the Power Ultra Lounge in downtown Little Rock. Police have said they believe the shooting stemmed from a dispute in the crowd and may be gang-related. The Marshals Service said Hampton and another man were arrested at the Side Effects Club in Birmingham, where Hampton was performing. The rapper took the stage in Birmingham just a day after gunfire broke out as he was performing at the Power Ultra Lounge. 25 people between the ages of 16 and 35 suffered gunshot wounds, and three others were hurt after the shooting early Saturday. A message posted on the rapper's Facebook page Saturday offered thoughts and prayers for those injured. "The violence is not for the club people. We all come with one motive at the end of the day, and that's to have fun." A woman who answered a phone number listed on Finesse Two Times' Instagram account for booking said the rapper didn't consider canceling the Birmingham show despite the shooting because he wasn't responsible for what happened. The woman didn't give her name before hanging up. The volley of gunfire inside the Power Ultra Lounge came so fast that investigators believe multiple people had to have been involved. Police Chief Kenton Buckner credited quick work by first responders for there being no fatalities. Courtney Swanigan, 23, told the Associated Press that when the gunfire rang out, "I just closed my eyes, got down on the ground, and put my hands on my head." City officials said they would move Monday to shut down the club under a criminal abatement program. State regulators suspended the club's liquor license Saturday, and a representative for the landlord's office later posted an eviction notice on a door to the club. The notice stated that the club must move out of the property within 3 days due to your failure to maintain the premises in a safe condition. Mayor Mark Stodola said the city must keep guns out of the hands of the wrong people and suggested that people refuse to patronize clubs that seem to promote violence. Material advertising the concert by the Tennessee rapper Finesse Two Times showed a man pointing a gun at a camera. A promotional video with a gun on the front cover inviting people to a concert should also be totally unacceptable in our community, the mayor said. The shooting capped a violent week in Arkansas's largest city. Police had responded to a dozen drive-by shootings over the previous 9 days. "I'm sick of all the killing and I'm tired of all the shooting. The kids getting hurt," said Raida Bunch, who was waiting outside the club after hearing from a friend that her son had been inside. She found out later that he had run from the club when the shooting started and was not hurt. The club's license has been suspended 11 times for failing to pay taxes, and it's been cited 7 times for 14 various violations, including unknowingly furnishing alcohol to minors and allowing alcohol to leave the premises since 2012, ABC Director of Enforcement Boyce Hamlet said. In May, one person was killed and 6 people were hurt in a mass shooting at a downtown concert in Jonesboro, Arkansas, about 115 miles northeast of Little Rock. In that case, 2 men were charged with first-degree murder and 6 counts of first-degree battery. Arkansas lawmakers earlier this year approved a measure expanding where concealed handguns can be carried, including bars if allowed by owners, for licensees who undergo additional training. The law takes effect in September, but the training likely won't be available until early next year. Samsung's exploding Galaxy Note 7 phone is coming back from the dead, by Reuters. Samsung Electronics said on Sunday that it will start selling a refurbished version of the recalled Galaxy Note 7 smartphone in South Korea on July 7th, using batteries different from those that caused some handsets to catch fire last year. Samsung said in a statement it will offer 400,000 phones, dubbed the Galaxy Note 7 Fan Edition, in its home country, priced at 699,600 won, $611, about 30% lower than the Note 7's original launch price. The devices will be made from recalled, unsealed Note 7 handsets and unused Note 7 components. Batteries for the refurbished devices will have a lower capacity than those of the original Note 7s, but have passed new safety measures implemented following the recall, Samsung said. The world's biggest smartphone maker by volume was forced to halt sales of the Note 7 in October, roughly 2 months after its launch, due to fire-prone batteries from two different suppliers. The incident cost Samsung over $5 billion in operating profit and damaged its reputation, though the firm has since recovered with the successful launch of the Galaxy S8. The firm said earlier this year it planned to sell refurbished Note 7s after investigations by Samsung and independent firms concluded the batteries were solely responsible for the fires. Samsung also plans to hold a launch event for the Note 8 in the second half of August, a source told Reuters last month. The firm said it will decide whether to sell the refurbished Note 7s in other markets at a later date. It has said it does not plan to offer the device in the United States or India. Don Winslow, Mexican Journalists Risk Death to Tell the Truth, by Don Winslow. Winslow is the author of The Cartel and The Force. On May 15, 2017, journalist Javier Valdez Cardenas left his office in his native Culiacán, a city that is the very heart of the Sinaloa cartel. Valdez had dedicated his career to covering the drug trade and the corruption of police and politicians that went with it. He and a few colleagues had founded Rio Doce, a weekly publication dedicated to the topic. He had written books. In 2011, the Committee to Protect Journalists awarded Valdez its International Press Freedom Award for courageous journalism. Yeah, writing about the Sinaloa cartel while living and working in Culiacán requires a kind of courage that is almost incomprehensible. He had been threatened with death, his offices attacked with grenades. But he wouldn't stop. To die, he said, would be to quit writing. That Monday morning in May, Valdez got into his car and was only a block from the Rio Doce office when gunmen stopped his car and shot him 12 times. Valdez was 50 years old. He was not the only journalist murdered that day. Hector Jonathan Rodriguez Cordova, a reporter for La UNESCO, was killed in Jalisco, the base of the New Generation Jalisco cartel. But it had already been a bloody, tragic spring for Mexican journalists. Carlos Alberto Garcia Martinez killed in Colima, Cecilia Pineda Berto in Guerrero, Ricardo Monluí Cabrera in Veracruz, Miroslava Breach Veldusea in Chihuahua, Maximino Rodriguez Palacios in Baja, Filiberto Alvarez Landeros in Morelos, and the slaughter of journalists by narco-traffickers wouldn't stop. 3 days after the murders of Valdez and Rodriguez, television reporter Salvador Adame Pardo disappeared. He has not been found. Nor, sadly, was the spring of 2017 exceptional. In 2015, I published a book, The Cartel, about the drug wars in Mexico. The novel was dedicated to Mexican journalists who were killed or had disappeared during the 5 years it took me to write the book. The dedication listed 131 names. Since then, at least 39 more journalists have been murdered. Miroslava Briach, 54, was shot 8 times in her car while pulling out of her driveway to take one of her children to school. The child was unharmed, if you can call watching your mother bleed to death in front of you unharmed. The killers left behind a manta, a note, for being a loudmouth. Briach was the Chihuahua correspondent for the national newspaper La Jornada and also a contributor to the Ciudad Juarez paper El Norte. After Briach's death, El Norte published an announcement that it was shutting down because it didn't want to see any more of its reporters killed. The headline read, Adios. That's what's behind the cartel's murders of journalists. They're trying, with some success, to shut down the free press. The cartels, like other terrorist organizations, have discovered that it isn't enough to control events, that they have to control the narrative as well. Media savvy, the cartels put out their own press releases on social media and use these to influence and intimidate the populations they need to dominate in order to stay in business. Independent reporters and publications are a threat to that dominance. So the cartels have threatened and often bribed journalists to either not write stories or to write the version that the particular cartel wants told. If threats and bribes don't work, the cartels resort to murder and kidnapping. Some journalists have been complicit with the cartels, but most often the bribes aren't optional. The choice is to take the money, usually a weekly envelope, or be killed. Other journalists have been caught in an impossible bind between two rival cartels demanding conflicting versions of stories. Either way the reporter writes the story might get him killed. Cartels actually monitor reporters' radios and cell phones and, after a murder, for instance, tell a reporter when or if he can go to the site and what facts he can report or not. Photojournalists have been tortured, murdered, and dismembered for shooting the bodies of the wrong cartel victims. Radio and television stations have been attacked with shoulder-fired rockets. The result has been a dunning effect on the Mexican media. Some print and broadcast outlets have simply stopped covering drug stories. Others, like El Norte, have simply shut down. The government offers no help. Politicians have doubtless encouraged some of these murders. Corrupt police officers on the cartel's payrolls have doubtless played a role as well. The very people who are supposed to protect journalists have been their executioners. And yet, Mexican journalists, brave beyond belief, carry on, risking their lives to tell the truth. Some work for traditional newspapers, radio and television stations, others on websites, blogs, and other social media. They carry on in the tradition of Javier Valdez and so many others that to die would be to quit writing. I would name them, but the sad fact is that I'm afraid to, afraid that it might spur some narco thug to murder them. The death of the free press is the first step in the death of democracy. With the continuous slaughter of its journalists, the already shaky Mexican democracy is walking toward the grave. The question is whether it will go there in silence. Americans are totally obsessed with avocados thanks to this man, by Emmeline Rude. Sometime in the 1920s, on the outskirts of Los Angeles, a friendly neighborhood postal worker decided to buy himself an avocado seed. This he did with much success and subsequently planted the seed in his backyard with the intention of grafting another variety of avocado onto it. The grafts would not take, however, and the postman next came to the conclusion that he may as well chop down the uncooperative tree. It was his children who convinced the postman, Mr. Rudolph Haas, to save this particular fruit tree. They believed its fruits were much more flavorful than those of the avocados that could be found in the market. In doing so, Mr. Haas's children not only saved what would soon become their father's legacy, but also changed the face of avocado toast and guacamole as we now know it. In 1935, Mr. Haas took a patent out on what he named the Haas Avocado, a prolific variety of the fleshy and buttery fruit that now comprises 95% of the over 4 billion avocados eaten annually in the United States each year. The avocado culinary landscape of today is vastly different from that of Rudolf Haas's day. While the average American today chows down on nearly 7 pounds of avocado in any given year, avocado consumption anywhere outside of California was virtually non-existent a century ago. For one thing, although the fruit had been grown as an ornamental plant in the United States since at least the 1830s, there was no commercial avocado industry yet established anywhere in the country. For another, avocados as we now know them had a bit of a marketing problem. The aguacate, this rough-skinned and pear-shaped fruit, had been a staple in the diets of Central and South America since at least 500 BC, and Spanish conquistadors, too, had fallen in love with its nutty flavor and buttery texture when they first encountered it in the 16th century. The problem was that aguacate, which is spelled A-H-U-A-C-A-T-E, was decidedly hard for many early 20th century Americans to pronounce. And, in fact, the word was Aztec for testicle, a name that reinforced the fruit's legend as an aphrodisiac and made it much more difficult to sell to the rather prudish American eating public. But for those eaters in the know at the beginning of the 20th century, the majority of whom happened to be in avocado-growing regions in Florida and California, the fruit was already a smash hit. The finest hotels in Los Angeles and San Francisco were selling these fruits for a dollar each, the equivalent of roughly $24 today, earning them the nickname among farmers of green gold. The most valuable fruit trees in the world at the time were avocado trees. But still, there was that phallic name. The delicious fruit did go by a host of other, more Europeanized calling cards over the centuries, having been known as the aguacate to the Spanish and the midshipman's butter to English sailors. At some point, by the late 19th century, Americans had begun to call the crop the alligator pear, another name in which growers saw their own ruin. So, on May 15, 1915, gathered at another posh hotel in Los Angeles, a cadre of California growers invented their own name, the avocado. They informed the nation's dictionaries of their decision and organized themselves into the California Avocado Association to champion their cause. At first, with their fruits relatively scarce and retailing at exorbitant prices, the newfangled avocado was sold as a luxury good. Typically of the larger and highly seasonal Fuerte variety, advertisements in Vogue and the New Yorker throughout the 1920s declared the avocado the aristocrat of salad fruits, and famed chefs were commissioned to mix the fruit with grapefruit or stuff it with lobster and serve it up to their well-heeled clientele. But as the decades wore on, as Mr. Haas's high-quality and heavily producing tree became more widely adopted amongst avocado growers, production scaled up and prices dropped from a dollar down to as low as 25 cents each by the 1950s, at which point the broader public began to pay attention to this decadent fruit. In fact, as early as 1960, the New York Times advised its readers to slice and spread the green flesh on toast, preceding Instagram's appreciation of avo toast by at least a half century. And the avocado's popularity continued to increase, thanks in no small part to the surge in immigration from Latin America that followed the passage of the 1965 Immigration and Naturalization Act. The avocado is, after all, indigenous to Central and South America and widely used in a multitude of the region's cuisines. When Latin Americans arrived in the United States, they brought their love of the avocado with them, a trend that still holds today. In fact, for at least the past decade, according to the Haas Avocado Board, 90% of all Hispanic Americans declared themselves avocado eaters, while that number is only at 50% for the rest of the population. The low-fat crusades of the 1980s did leave a dent on consumption of the famously fatty avocado, but by the 1990s, with a wave of avocados shipped in from Mexico thanks to NAFTA and yet another savvy marketing push by avocado growers to link guacamole with the Super Bowl, prices dropped yet again and consumption skyrocketed. Americans' modern obsession with this buttery fruit has blossomed to such prolific heights today that the entire continent is currently experiencing a shortage of them. That's likely more than Rudolf Haas ever could have predicted when his fruit experiment almost failed, but the perfect cap to what might be called America's avocado century. Emmeline Rude is a food historian and the author of Tastes Like Chicken, available now. Dave McClure of 500 Startups to Women, I'm a Creep, I'm Sorry, by Alana Abramson. Dave McClure, a co-founder of the venture fund 500 Startups, publicly apologized late Saturday following an allegation of sexual harassment that led to a reduction of his responsibilities at his company, acknowledging that he had made inappropriate advances toward women on several occasions. I made advances towards multiple women in work-related situations where it was clearly inappropriate, McClure wrote in a post on Medium. I put people in compromising and inappropriate situations, and I selfishly took advantage of those situations where I should have known better. My behavior was inexcusable and wrong. The post was headlined simply, "I'm a creep. I'm sorry." For these and other incidents where I have been at fault, I would like to apologize for being a clueless, selfish, unapologetic, and defensive ass, he added. To all those I let down, and especially to those I directly offended and hurt, I'm very sorry. In an article late last month about sexual harassment in the technology industry, the New York Times interviewed female entrepreneur Sarah Kunst, who said she and McClure had been discussing potential work opportunities in 2014 when he wrote her a Facebook message saying, "I was getting confused figuring out whether to hire you or hit on you." Kunst told The Times she raised the Facebook message with one of McClure's colleagues, after which the company stopped discussing opportunities with her. 500 startups told The Times the company had made changes internally after being informed of McClure's actions toward women and that he was no longer in charge of the company's daily operations. He recognizes he has made mistakes and has been going through counseling to work on addressing changes in his previous unacceptable behavior, the company said. McClure's co-founder, Christine Tsai, wrote in a blog post on the company's website that his behavior was unacceptable and not reflective of 500's culture and values. McClure acknowledged his advances toward Kunst were inappropriate, adding that he didn't offer her a job but referred her to Tsai, who met with her but decided not to extend an offer. "My apologies to Sarah for my inappropriate behavior in a setting I thought was social, but in hindsight was clearly not," he wrote. "It was my fault, and I take full responsibility. She was correct in calling me out. I don't expect anyone to believe I will change," he continued, "but I'm working on it."
President Trump just tweeted a video of him punching CNN in the face by Alana Abramson. President Donald Trump posted a video to Twitter on Sunday that depicts him punching a physical representation of CNN in the face, the latest escalation in his ongoing war against the news media, and one that raised the specter of actual violence. The video, posted Sunday morning to Trump's Twitter feed, is of an actual 2007 staged spectacle in a wrestling arena when Trump, then a reality TV star, brought WWE head Vince McMahon to the ground in their Battle of the Billionaires. But the video was edited with CNN's logo imposed on McMahon's face. In the video, Trump spends about 10 seconds punching the opponent with the CNN logo before the now president walks away, seemingly unscathed. The video concludes with an image similar to CNN's logo, but with the acronym FNN, representing Fraud News Network, Trump's latest moniker for one of his most frequent media targets. Thomas Bossert, a Homeland Security advisor to Trump, was asked about the tweet on ABC News this week with George Stephanopoulos. "My first reaction to that tweet would be the same as any of the president's tweets. There's a lot of cable news shows that reach directly into hundreds of thousands of viewers, and they're really not always fair to the president," Bossert said. "No one would perceive that as a threat. I hope they don't," Bossert continued, "but I do think that he's beaten up in a way on cable programs that he has a right to respond to." But other reactions to the tweet, which came just days after Trump attacked MSNBC's Morning Joe co-hosts Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski, included concern for the safety of reporters. "It is an incitement to violence," Republican strategist Anna Navarro, who is a commentator on CNN, said on This Week. "He is going to get somebody killed in the media." CNN at first responded on Twitter by simply quoting White House spokeswoman Sarah Huckabee Sanders, who said only days earlier that Trump in no way, form, or fashion has ever promoted or encouraged violence. The cable news network later called it a sad day when the president of the United States encourages violence against reporters. The full statement from CNN: "It is a sad day when the president of the United States encourages violence against reporters." Clearly, Sarah Huckabee Sanders lied when she said the president had never done so. Instead of preparing for his overseas trip, his first meeting with Vladimir Putin, dealing with North Korea, and working on his health care bill, he is instead involved in juvenile behavior far below the dignity of his office. "We will keep doing our jobs. He should start doing his." Brian Stelter, CNN's senior media correspondent, noted on Twitter that the video had surfaced on a Reddit thread days earlier with the caption, "Trump takes down fake news."
What are they trying to hide? President Trump questions 25 states refusing to hand over voter information. By Lisa Marie Segarra. More states are pushing back against President Donald Trump's Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity. As of Friday, 25 states have refused to give partial or full requested information, according to the Washington Post. Some states cited state laws prohibiting them from releasing certain voter information, while others opposed the information request due to the nature of the commission itself, the Post reported. Trump tweeted about the subject Saturday morning, writing, "Numerous states are refusing to give information to the very distinguished voter fraud panel. What are they trying to hide?" Trump's Commission on Voter Fraud asked each state to provide personal data on all registered voters going back to 2006. California, New York, and Virginia were the first states to balk at the request. Mississippi's Secretary of State Delbert Hoseman gained attention for his statement on refusing to provide the information. "They can go jump in the Gulf of Mexico, and Mississippi is a great state to launch from," Hoseman, a Republican, said Friday. "Mississippi residents should celebrate Independence Day and our state's right to protect the privacy of our citizens by conducting our own electoral processes." 14 Amazon Shopping Tricks Everyone Should Know by Bridget Early for Real Simple. You already know about all the secret perks that come with a Prime membership, but some of these lesser-known shopping tips can help save more money, and you don't even need Prime. 1. You can trade in unwanted items for cash. Amazon accepts a long list of electronics, tablets, phones, cameras, video games, and more, as well as books and textbooks in exchange for a gift card. Items must be in acceptable condition and shipping is included. 2. They price match TVs. Within 30 days of purchasing a television, the retailer will match a lower price advertised on Amazon or at another qualifying retailer. The refund, which takes any differences in shipping or promotions into account, will be given in the form of an Amazon.com gift card. 3. You can score a great deal on open box products. Like floor models in a traditional store, Amazon Warehouse offers TVs and other electronics, as well as home goods that have been opened, damaged, used, or refurbished at deep discounts. Items are listed by quality, very good, acceptable, or like new, and are backed by Amazon's return policy to ensure buyers know what they're getting. 4. They have an outlet, too. You can shop for items on sale in virtually every category, clothing, jewelry, electronics, and more, by using Amazon Outlet. Here, you'll find markdowns, clearance items, and overstocks up to 80% off. 5. You can rent textbooks. Save up to 80% on study materials when you borrow instead of buy. All textbooks arrive in acceptable condition with minimal writing and highlighting. 6. Students can save in other ways, too. As a student, you're eligible for a 6-month free trial of Amazon Prime. Once the 6 months are up, you can get Prime for $49, 50% off the standard membership price, for up to 4 years. Students are also eligible for exclusive deals and discounts. 7. Parents also get special perks. Amazon Family offers special discounts and coupons on select household goods, age-based product recommendations, 20% off diaper subscriptions, and 15% off remaining baby registry items. 8. You can set up and save on recurring deliveries. Save up to 15% by subscribing to thousands of items, toilet paper, coffee pods, laundry detergent, and more. Simply select the quantity, the delivery frequency, and start date. 9. You can share your Prime benefits. Two adults living in the same household, that includes roommates, can share select Prime benefits like free shipping, free video streaming, photo storage, early access to sales, and more. Simply add an adult in Amazon household. 10. Shopping for gifts is easier. In addition to baby and wedding registries, Amazon also provides gift suggestions by recipient, adults, kids, toddlers, and babies, and then narrows it down even further by offering filters, anytime gifts, beauty, pretend play, books, and more. Users can also create searchable wish lists. 11. Readers have an entire library at their fingertips. For $10 per month, Kindle users, device or app, can choose from more than 1 million books and thousands of audiobooks. Bonus, the first month is free. Don't want the monthly subscription? Each day, Kindle Daily Deals offers a number of new books at discounted prices. 12. You can shop with points. Have a credit card that accumulates rewards points? You can use those points to pay for goods on Amazon. Simply use that card and indicate how many points you want to apply towards your purchase during checkout. 13. You can save on apps and games. Amazon has its own digital currency called Amazon Coins. You can buy those coins, 100 coins for $1, and then use them to pay for apps, games, and in-app purchases at a discount of up to 25% off. And number 14, Amazon makes good on missed delivery dates. If an item qualified for free shipping through Amazon Prime and was not delivered on time, you may be eligible for a one-month extension on your membership. Shipping costs will be refunded to those without Prime. This story originally appeared on Real Simple. I Just Closed My Eyes, 25 People Shot in Nightclub, by the Associated Press in Little Rock, Arkansas. Clubgoers screamed and scrambled for cover as dozens of gunshots rang out during a rap concert in downtown Little Rock early Saturday, leaving 25 people shot and three others injured from an 11-second melee that police quickly said was not related to terrorism. All of the victims were expected to survive the shooting at Power Ultra Lounge, about a mile from the state capitol building. Police believe the gunfire erupted amid a dispute among clubgoers and that multiple people fired shots. 25 people suffered gunshot wounds and three others had unrelated injuries. I just closed my eyes, got down on the ground, and put my hands on my head, Courtney Swanigan, 23, told the Associated Press. The shooting capped a violent week in Arkansas's largest city. Police had responded to a dozen drive-by shootings over the previous 9 days, but haven't said whether any of the incidents are related. Little Rock's crime problem appears to be intensifying, Republican Governor Asa Hutchinson said in a statement. Every few days, it seems, a high-profile shooting dominates the news, culminating with this morning's event. I have spoken this morning with Mayor Mark Stodola, and I have offered both my heartfelt concern over this senseless violent tragedy and state assets as needed to address the continued threat of violence in our community. A Facebook video posted from inside the club included audio of at least 24 rounds fired in about 11 seconds. Daryl Rankin, who posted the video, said a friend of his who attended the concert with him had a bullet stuck in his spine. Police were summoned about 2:30 a.m. City police said quickly that the agency did not believe the shooting was part of a terrorist attack and that no active shooter remained at the scene. Some sort of dispute broke out between people inside, Police Chief Kenton Buckner told reporters. Stodola said more information would be released at a news conference Saturday afternoon. The club's Facebook page promoted Friday night's show with a poster depicting a man pointing what appears to be a gun at the camera. Calls to a number listed for the booking agent for the show weren't returned Saturday, but a message was posted on the artist's Facebook page offering thoughts and prayers for those injured. The violence is not for the club people. We all come with one motive at the end of the day, and that's to have fun. Police cordon off the area as technicians collected evidence from the scene, which is near a Roman Catholic cathedral and a First United Methodist Church center. A number of worshippers gathered for a funeral at St. Andrew's while police still worked at the scene. Glass from the Power Ultra Lounge's second-story windows littered the ground, along with empty drink cups. In the parking lot, a silver Toyota had what appeared to be a streak of blood on the front passenger side door. "I'm sick of all the killing, and I'm tired of all the shooting. The kids getting hurt," said Raida Bunch, who was waiting outside of the club after hearing from a friend that her son had been inside. She found out later that he had run from the club when the shooting started and wasn't hurt. Arkansas Alcoholic Beverage Control officials suspended the club's alcohol license and set a hearing for July 10th on three potential charges: disorderly conduct, allowing possession of weapons on the premises, and failure to be a good neighbor. The club's license has been suspended 11 times for failing to pay taxes, and it's been cited 7 times for 14 various violations, including unknowingly furnishing alcohol to minors and allowing alcohol to leave the premises since 2012, ABC Director of Enforcement Boyce Hamlet said. In May, one person was killed and 6 people were hurt in a mass shooting at a downtown concert in Jonesboro, Arkansas, about 115 miles northeast of Little Rock. In that case, 2 men were charged with first-degree murder and 6 counts of first-degree battery. Arkansas lawmakers earlier this year approved a measure expanding where concealed handguns can be carried, including bars if allowed by owners, for licensees who undergo additional training. The law takes effect in September, but the training likely won't be available until early next year. Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.